Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In a little while, a live performance by Morris Robinson, an operatic bass who went from the football fields of the Citadel to some of the biggest concert stages in the opera world. But first, 2007 is just beginning. We thought we'd try to apply a little science to the music world by asking, what will survive? And we begin with the survivors. The Beatles are inarguably at the top of the heap, and Beethoven's place at the top of the musical kingdom is well in hand as well. So we thought we'd ask, is there such a thing as musical Darwinism? Do Darwin's laws of natural selection apply in the music world? To answer these questions, we've invited Dr. Leon Botstein, the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra, and Warren Zanes, who runs the education and public programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, to join us today. Leon's on the phone. Warren's with me here in the studio. And Leon, let me start with you. There are works that are universally admired, Beethoven and the Beatles, just two of them. Is this an example of survival of the fittest? Are they the most musically fit examples of their respective genres and times?
And not at all. It's a matter of a sort of cultural taste that comes and goes. Debussy, for example, wasn't particularly interested in Beethoven. Stravinsky wasn't interested in Beethoven. There are ebbs and flows even in Beethoven's standing. There is no objective natural selection in the sense of Darwin, no evolutionary logic that can predict or even that creates the circumstances by which some pieces survive and others don't. Some survive and disappear, then they reappear. Some come out of the blue in some cases. Some are unfairly forgotten, though there's no issue of merit. Sometimes it's a matter of politics, taste, good fortune, luck. It's all very subjective. There is no scientific basis for aesthetic superiority.
All right. Well, it's nice to think that there might be some science at work here, Warren, but Leon mentions the word luck. And is that your vision of this, too, that luck plays a big part in it?
Luck, chance, there's definitely a category that you can't put your finger on. In popular music, and the channels of transmission are very different from the classical world, of course, I tried to break out some categories. You know, why does a song last? And I think great performances last. I think some songs last simply because they're associated with a particular time. Are they great songs? Not necessarily, but they're associated with the moment. And when we want to remember that moment, we use the music to do that.
All right. Now, and we actually have some examples of each of those things. But let me come back to the Beatles and Beethoven thing. The Beatles, I mean, it seems to me that whatever element of chance was involved in their ascendance back in the 60s, we continue to listen to them over 40 years later. That music has survived because it is genuinely some of the fittest of that time.
Well, it's another way of saying, I mean, that the Beatles are good and the Beethoven is good in the sense that it's high craftsmanship, a lot of invention, and that it has the ability for different generations to make meaning of it means it's good. No one's denying that. But the fact is, once it gets really on the charts, so to speak, then there is a kind of inherited expectation. Now, Beethoven wrote some bad music. He wrote some lousy music. I don't know whether the Beatles wrote bad songs, but Beethoven wrote some really embarrassing music. So it isn't a function of a kind of special gift. A couple of those pieces really are terrific, and people have found something in them, different things, over many generations. I think the same is probably true of the Beatles, but it doesn't make it the best.
What about Warren, the Beatles?
Well, the Beatles, if you look, let's say before they started having hits, they got themselves onto a platform where that career became possible. And situations could have happened differently that they didn't get to that platform. But, you know, they got there. I don't think it was inevitable. But that doesn't detract from the fact that if you compare them to their peers, there is something extra going on with the Beatles.
All right. Now,
the same is true with Beethoven.
Okay. Now, Darwin's theory includes this notion of competition, that due to environmental pressures, organisms within a population must compete with each other to survive. Now, the pop music field, Warren, is a particularly crowded one. So you really do. I mean, there is this competition at work. And you were talking before about these elements that a song needs to be able to survive, to be able to last beyond its pop moment on the charts. One was room for identification. Is that, you mean listener identification?
Yeah, exactly. When a song is written so that the widest possible audience can sit, listen to it, and feel like it was written for them, this level of identification between singer and listener is so deep that everybody feels this absolutely personal connection, but it happens that millions feel the same way. Well, that song's probably going to be remembered.
So give us an example. You pick Tom Petty?
To me, Tom Petty's Free Fallin', which has very concrete images in the verses, but then when it gets to the chorus, it's this wide open sentiment of something like a personal freedom.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that any listener coming at it from different angles could still identify with potentially.
Yeah, the combination of that melody with those sentiments, it just makes this huge space for a listener to get in there.
All right, Tom Petty's Free Falling.
For breaking her heart.
All right, so Warren Zanes from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland telling us that leaving room for listeners to identify with a song, that's something that can give it some legs, you know, to stand on over the long haul. You also mentioned things that are emblematic of a particular time.
Yeah, for instance, when I'm shopping with my sons, I'm in Whole Foods and I hear, say, Culture Club, you know, Karma Chameleon. It's not necessarily my favorite song. I don't think it is an example of the finest moment in pop songwriting craft, but it takes me right back to when that was
to the
at
early
the top
80s.
Of the charts.
Okay.
And that time travel that music allows, I think, is one of the reasons we love music.
Now, you said, you told us earlier, Billy Ray Cyrus's Achy Breaky Heart, which was ubiquitous some years ago, that serves the same function for a lot of people.
It was everywhere in one moment. Is it a good song? You're not going to find me arguing that. But when we hear it, we have that time travel, and I think it will stick around for that reason alone.
All right.
You can tell my arms go back into the fall. You can tell my feet to hit the floor. Or you can tell my lips to tell my fingertips.
All right, Billy Ray Cyrus's Achy Breaky Heart. Part of me quails at the thought of us still listening to this, you know, 50 years, 100 years from now. But it does, you know, it is an emblem of a particular time. The third thing that you said, and this will bring us back to our other guest, Leon Botstein, is the great performance as a way to cement music's place in history.
Yeah, and I think of, you know, take Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, take a Rolling Stones' Gimme Shelter. You know, some of the best Elvis Presley sides, some of the best 60s soul. It was the sound of a band playing together, of a deep groove, a rhythm section locked right in, and they've got a good song, and it's suddenly, it's you know, there's this one take that's magic, and that can get the song into the canon.
And for you, Jimi Hendrix and Wild Thing?
If you compare Wild Thing of the Troggs,
the original hit,
with Wild Thing of Hendrix is a guy who we remember him as a quintessential rock and roll performer. The way he could drop into even someone else's material, it's going to make him remembered.
Jimi Hendrix and his version of Wild Thing. We're talking about natural selection. Is there a musical Darwinism at work in determining what music survives and what gets left behind in the dustbin of history? My guests are Warren Zanes, who runs the education and public programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, and Leon Botstein, the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and also president of Bard College. So, Leon, you heard Warren talking about these kind of three elements that enable a song, or a pop song at least, to survive. Classical music works on a different time scale, and almost, you know, it's almost like, you know, comparing Mesozoic and Cenozoic eras to, you know, January, February, March in terms of the time span. Are these same elements at work in the classical world?
Yeah, in part. For example, we make associations between music and places and landscape. So let's say Elgar, the Pomp and Circumstance March, became almost a second national anthem, or his Nimrod variation in the Enigma variations. When we think of Finland, we think, you know, Sibelius, we think Russian music tells us something about Russia. Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, all of Aaron Copland's music has become evocative of the American Western landscape, even though he was a homosexual Jewish boy from Brooklyn and didn't spend that much time out west. His music became the emblem of the wide open American space. So that happens in classical music, and there's a lot of competition as well, and a lot of imitation.
Mm-hmm.
And performers often have something to do with it. They can deliver, you know, a piece, and their delivery of the piece helps put it into the repertoire.
That's what I wanted to get to. We just heard Jimi Hendrix. Would Jascha Heifetz, for example, be to, you know, certain classical pieces that are now considered staples, what Hendrix was to the songs that he made famous?
Absolutely. I think the Sibelius and Korngold concertos are two examples of Heifetz, really, his advocacy of them put them on the map.
Mm-hmm. What about even something like the Beethoven Violin Concerto?
Well, the Beethoven Violin Concerto was put on the map by Joseph Joachim, the 19th century violinist. It was dead. People thought it was sort of bad Beethoven, and nobody paid much attention to it until really the 1840s and 50s, long after Beethoven's death. Joachim really single-handedly put this thing into the repertoire. It's now one of the staple violin concertos.
So we actually have a recording of Jascha Heifetz, in fact, doing the Beethoven Violin Concerto. Jascha Heifetz and the Beethoven Violin Concerto in D, an example of music that has survived after a rocky interregnum,
right,
when Beethoven died. Leon Botstein, how do you explain great work in the classical canon that just disappears? Is it because the composition itself was inherently flawed, or is there something else going on?
It's a mixture of politics and, in the modern times, fear. Popular music, it's usually long duration and expensive to put on the stage. And before recording, you're getting a symphony played, an opera done. It's a massive undertaking. It costs millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And public performance, is much more important to the history of classical music than recording. So in the age before recording, you know, if somebody didn't pick it up, if an orchestra didn't play it every year, if there weren't 80 performances of it in the first 2 years all over the world, you had trouble. even though they printed it and they had a piano reduction of it and people could learn it, you know, it sort of disappeared. So a lot of good music has remained unplayed or underplayed and has nothing to do with the quality of the music. And therewith, politics and luck plays a big role.
All right. Now, you've made a career of championing some lesser-known composers. I mean, maybe in their day they were quite well-known, but and pieces by well-known composers that have fallen by the wayside. When you go rummaging through, you know, music history, are you finding pieces that you think, you know, are just as good inherently, you know, as compositions as the things that are in the standard repertoire?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And there are, in fact, there are good pieces, there are bad pieces by famous composers that get played because the composers are famous. But for example, there's a symphony by Ernst von Dohnányi, contemporary of Bartók's, and Hungarian, was a conductor and composer, fantastically talented guy. Now, these pieces always have a good history. So Bartók liked this piece. It was successful when it first appeared, but vanished for a variety of reasons, part political and part because he didn't have that much music. He was better known as a pianist than a conductor.
Mm-hmm.
There's, for example, a Strauss opera. Richard Strauss is very famous for Rosenkavalier and Elektra and Salome and tone poems. The later operas, people said they're just, you know, the guy's writing himself out, you know, he's just imitating himself. They don't have the originality. They're not as good as the first version, like having a great first novel and not a good second and third novel. Well, I just think that's wrong. And so when you get away from the initial failure or the initial forgetting, and you look at this with a fresh eye, it really pops out.
And so you have resurrected the Strauss opera, The Egyptian Helen. And in fact, now it's coming to the Met.
It's coming to the Met, yes.
In March.
For the first time. Absolutely. With
Deborah Voigt.
Almost 100 years after its premiere. Well, 80 years after its premiere.
All right. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a case of musical Darwinism, whether you are, in fact, playing the role of Darwin to an extent with that piece. But we'll continue our conversation in just a moment about what survives in music and why. And we'll also open the phones to hear your theories on the musically fittest. And then later in the program, the bass Morris Robinson joins us to revive some great American spirituals right here in the studio. Our phone number is 212-264-7483, 212-264-7483. And of course, you can always email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. Back with both Leon Botstein and Warren Zanes and musical Darwinism in just a moment. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Still to come, football star turned opera star Morris Robinson tells us how he survived the transition from the sports field to the opera stage. Right now, though, we're looking at musical survival of the fittest. Is there such a thing as natural selection in music? What determines which music survives? Are there pieces of music that have been consigned to the dustbins of history that are just as deserving as, for example, Bruce Springsteen, whom we're hearing in the background? Now, Springsteen has been championed by critics and fans alike. How long will his legacy last? That remains to be seen. We're speaking with Dr. Leon Botstein, who is the music director of the American Symphony Orchestra and president of Bard College, and with Warren Zanes, musician, author, and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame educator. We're opening the phones for your calls as well at 212-264-7483. Is there some kind of musical Darwinism at work? Is it all just luck? What's been missed? Do you have your own theory of how music survives? 212-264-7483. Warren Zanes, Bruce Springsteen, critically acclaimed, But even more important, had the fans to really kind of carry him through a lengthy career.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I was talking about identification, Springsteen tells the story of the outsider, the disenfranchised. Right there, you've got an enormous audience. Yes, it's grounded in the particularities of this Jersey Shore experience, but that doesn't limit it, because to feel like an outsider, you know, is the human experience. So Springsteen opens up a big territory in the history of music. When he came along, it was a back-to-basics thing, mm-hmm. which over the course of the history of rock and roll, this is a recurring theme to, you know, break it down to its essentials. That appealed to people in the moment. And then Springsteen's all about the great performance.
All right. Now, before we took the break, Leon Botstein was telling us about, you know, some of the things that he's found in music history, this Richard Strauss opera called The Egyptian Helena, and a number of other things that have been overlooked that were really deserving. In the pop world, Lonnie Donegan died just a couple of years ago, and when his obituary appeared in the newspaper, that was probably the first time anybody had heard the name Lonnie Donegan in like 35 years or more. He seems to me to be an example of someone who in his day was hugely ascendant, important in the music world, and then was just, you know, just kind of disappeared.
If you took Lonnie Donegan out of the picture, the story of rock and roll would be different, period. But history is a cruel master. In the popular telling is emphasized what happened stateside with an Elvis Presley bringing black and white traditions together, and that's been the dominant story. And so you have British, major figures in British music, the Eric Claptons, the Beatles, all of whom were raised on skiffle and Lonnie Donegan. No, that part of the story has been all but erased.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, why? I end up with the history is a cruel master, and we got comfortable with one narrative.
And that narrative is rockers write their own stuff. And in Lonnie Donegan's case, his big hit was a cover?
A cover. So, you know, retroactively, the fact that he wasn't writing his own material, I think, was one strike against him.
All right. But this was a huge hit for Lonnie Donegan, Rock Island Line.
A good old livestock, a good old livestock, a good old livestock. And you may say, well, you're all right, boy, just get on through. You don't have to pay me nothing. And the train go through. And when you go through the toll gate, the train got up a little bit of steam and a little bit of speed. And when the driver think he's safely on the other side, you shout back down the line to the man. He said, I fooled you, I fooled you. I got pig iron, I got pig iron, I got old pig iron. Now I'll tell you where I'm going, boy. Down the Rock Island Line, she's a mighty good road. The Rock Island Line is the road to ride, yes, the Rock Island Line.
Lonnie Donegan's Rock Island Line, as Warren Zanes was saying, Lonnie Donegan and the whole skiffle movement, really nothing more than a musical footnote in the history of rock as it is currently written. Let's go back to Leon Botstein. The history of classical music is one that has been written over a couple of centuries now, Leon. There are works, you know, as you discussed before, that deserve to be in the canon that are not there. What about works that are in the canon and, you know, maybe don't necessarily deserve to be there? I mean, you mentioned before Beethoven wrote a lot of almost embarrassing music. Why does a piece like Für Elisa continue to, you know, be a part of the repertoire?
Because piano teachers, as you see, the classical music has a different aspect because it survives on its players as well as the audience. So you're writing not only for an audience, but you're also writing for other musicians. And one of those musicians, a group of youth, can be teachers. And, you know, there are pieces that every piano student has looked at, Für Elise, Solfeggetto by C.P. Bach. Why these pieces have stayed in the teaching material, like in the Dick and Jane of learning how to play a piano, who knows? But this stuff just stays there. And you can find, I would say, tens of pieces from the same period that are as good.
All right, but Für Elise is the one that continues to appear in Charlie Brown cartoons and elsewhere, you know, so it's certainly gained a lot of traction even outside of the classical music realm. Our number is 212-264-7483. I want to take the first of our phone calls, and then, Warren, I want to get back to you with a similar question, but Frank in Staten Island, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi. How you doing? I know you just mentioned, like, Für Elise. like in a case, let's say, like Deep Purple, everyone knows that I think Smoke on the Water will survive. But there are many, many, many other Deep Purple songs that never get on the radio, and only the fans really like them. And in a sense, Darwinian-wise, they don't survive, but Smoke on the Water will survive. Well, I want to ask Warren a very big question about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. What's the deal with progressive rock? I'm a very big fan of prog rock. Yes, and Genesis and a lot of my favorite bands, ELP, are not in the Hall of Fame. They deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. What is the story? Because I'm going to go protest.
Well, you should protest. I mean, every Hall of Fame that doesn't have the people in that you think should be in, you should protest it. The nomination, the process is one that's largely, you know, a democratic process, so it's flawed as such.
It's flawed. But there is some natural selection taking place there, too. Well, and let's remember that's, you know, not ancient history yet. Let's still change.
Let's not forget the role of the critic. And that's where prog rock is left to the side.
Right.
Never a critical favorite.
All right. But I want to come back to something else that Frank said, which was the idea that, you know, certain songs remain because they were radio hits. Radio has changed dramatically. The gatekeepers, the tastemakers in pop music have changed dramatically in the last 10 or 20 years. How is that determining, to use a Darwinian word, how is that determining what's happening, what's staying, what's surviving?
Well, there are always going to be tastemakers. And yes, radio has changed significantly, as we all know. And there's, you know, a clear channel, the corporatization of radio. Situation's dramatically different. But I feel, on a positive note, that it empowers the listener, because you have a lot of fan communities who are more active than ever because of the way they use the internet, the way they use MySpace. So I feel like there are taste communities out there. But are they the taste communities that can send something to number one on the charts? I don't think we'll see that as much. It's not the same as that local DJ who, you know, I had mentioned earlier an example of Crowded House with Don't Dream It's Over. That was one DJ. The record had gone away. This one guy starts playing it. He builds a small audience. He's a tastemaker. Other DJs look at his playlist. They start playing it. Goes to number two on the charts. Those days, I think, are, for now, gone.
All right.
If I may say, in classical music, the tastemaker is important as well. And also, the tastemakers include not only critics, but people who put on concerts and also sometimes the players themselves. But the trouble in classical music is there's a tremendous amount of good material, more than can actually get out there. So the community is smaller. You don't have the large masses. It's not commercially viable. Never makes money. So you're talking about a lot of material going through a much more narrow window, and which is why probably in the classical side there's more stuff left behind.
Okay. Well, there is much more to be said, but that will have to be left behind for the moment, at least, as we are out of time. I'd like to thank both of our guests, Warren Zanes from the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Leon Botstein from the American Symphony Orchestra and Bard College. Gentlemen, thank you both for being with us this afternoon. It's a really kind of thought-provoking idea, and a pleasure speaking with both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, from the gridiron to the Met, operatic bass Morris Robinson joins us to share his fascinating story and to perform live in the studio. This is Soundcheck.
You're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? You think I crumble? You think I lay down and die? Oh, no, not I. I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll be.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. Thanks.